The Future of Teamwork is a Leader production. Subscribe today and never miss an episode.
Most companies do not have a culture of feedback. The culture of feedback is driven by the CEO, and it has to be exampled by the CEO. And the CEO has to have an all-hands meeting, so every single employee is there and say, we're going to build a culture of feedback. Here's what that looks like. Anybody at any level can say anything to anybody at any level, below, to the side, or above them, without being worried about being thrown under a bus.
Welcome to the Future of Teamwork podcast. My name's Dane Gruneveld, and today I'm joined by Carol Schultz. Carol has some very cool titles, CEO and founder of Vertical Elevation, host of Evolving Your Workplace, the podcast, and author of Powered by People. And I won't try and butcher the subtitle. I'll let Carol catch us up on that. Welcome to the show, Carol.
Good to be with you, Dane.
So we had some fun talking pre-show a little bit about your background, but I'd love, you know, for you to start from the top. What brought you to be doing this work, and particularly your I Free Hostages statement there on LinkedIn? It was super captivating for me, having spent some time in captivity.
Well, I'll give you the 100,000 foot view here. So I started in 1992, so I'm dating myself here, as a recruiter. And then in 1998, I began my coaching, training, and development work. And what I learned, certainly about recruiting, was the more I knew, the more I realized how broken the system was.
Yeah.
To only have been exacerbated in its spiraling down the toilet by the internet. I know there's a lot of people listening going, oh, come on, the internet's been great. Well, it has been great. Okay, but it's also ruined recruiting.
Mm.
Why, you might wonder? Well, because companies thought all we have to do is put somebody behind a desk and we can put an ad on, you know, online, and you're going to get zillions of resumes. But here's the thing. Ads online are just like the want ads, okay? You're only going to capture people who are looking for a job. So you miss the entire population of all the people who actually, a professional headhunter, which is what I did for 30 years, goes out and does. They headhunt people, which is why I, you know, refer to myself as a former professional headhunter, not recruiter, because there's a very distinct difference. And, you know, you have a background in that, so you understand what I'm saying. So, in the early 2000s, a buddy of mine said, I'm reading this book, which I, of course, could never possibly remember now, because it's been over 20 years. And he said, you should have written this book. You know more than this guy. And I said, no, I appreciate that. And it took me till 2022 to actually publish a book, which I said was called Powered by People. And the subtitle, How Talent-Centric Organizations Master Recruitment, Retention, and Revenue, and How to Build One. Did great. Hit the bestseller list in three different categories. I had been wanting to leave recruiting for a long time because of it being broken. Now, I did retain search in the last half of my career, so it's certainly a better process than contingency.
Mm-hmm.
You and I could talk about that another time. But ultimately, even retain search is broken in many different ways. So ultimately, I wrote this book, and what I discovered in writing the book and wanting to make this pivot out of recruiting was that if you ask founders and founder CEOs, CEOs and founder CEOs, right, what their top three priorities are, they're going to tell you, I mean, I could ask you what you think they are. What do you think they are?
For a CEO, top three priorities, I would go with talent, sales, and cash.
Okay, you're not far off. The answers they gave were revenue, product, and coming in at number three, talent. Now, what I say is, if you would just concentrate on number three, number one and number two are going to happen.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. That's the ass backwards way they look at this. So what I discovered was, even though I did great with the book and it, you know, all that did really, really well for me, what I discovered was, I am going to be barking up the wrong tree if I try to sell this.
Mm.
I did have some clients, but ultimately it just wasn't bringing in the revenue it needed to. So I'm at the gym one day, and I've spent my whole career like early in my career, I was working with big companies, tech firms, you know, Oracle, SAP, you know, crap like that. But of course, the tech boom happened in the late 90s. You and I are both not children. And I started working with startups and it was so exciting. So my background is primarily working with startups and small companies because I'm driven by the opportunity to make a difference. It is far more critical making a difference for those small companies than it is for a big giant company. If they make a bad hire, big deal.
Yeah.
They're not going to go out of business.
It'll hurt a few people's lives in the near term, but it's, the business keeps rolling.
Exactly. So I'm at the gym one day, a buddy of mine who's a fractional sales leader, been in sales his whole career. I was grousing to him about this and he said, oh, Carol, he goes, you should be a fractional chief of staff. And I thought, huh, that was living in a blind spot. And ultimately, I mean, I had a chief of staff. I'd placed chiefs of staff.
Yeah.
But none of that was ever a possibility. Now, I don't consider myself a chief of staff, but what that did is it started the journey of what are we really looking at here? And that turned into all the years of that I'd been doing what I was doing, coaching, recruiting, seeing all the mistakes that CEOs were making. God, and there's zillions of them. You know, I like to think I've seen everything. Nobody has actually seen everything, but I think I'm probably pretty close to seeing every stupid mistake a founder can make or a CEO can make, right?
Yeah.
So ultimately, we did a ton of research, and that turned into iFree Hostages, the organizational scaffold system. I go in as a fractional and work in the SMB space, primarily in the 5 to 40 million is my sweet spot, but up to, I'd say, 300. And I have a three-month, three-phase, nine-step process that I put in place. And then I backfill myself with a chief of staff who can carry on what I've done.
Yeah.
I will not go further. I've talked
enough. I love that. Yeah. That's so cool because I only recently found the chief of staff role. We acquired a business and they had a brilliant talent on the team, Lydia, who's still my chief of staff.
Good.
And she's come in and made a big difference in my world.
How so?
And I was like, oh, yeah, let's do it. I think the reality is having been in a CEO founder seat, to your point, lots of mistakes. In fact, my eight-year-old the other day, she was like, how are you going to afford that? And I was like, it's okay. Daddy knows how to make money. And she was like, I have no idea how. She just looked at me like.
That's hilarious.
But the reality is I made a lot of mistakes in life and I tend to be a little bit of a tornado. I love to do the creative problem solving, mm-hmm. the ideation. I love to put people together to say, hey, I'm sure you guys could do this great.
Yep.
But then building the systems and the scaffolding, to use your word,
yeah,
to make sure that it happens and people are clear on why it's happening and when it's happening is not a strength of mine.
Yeah.
So when I met Lydia and she came from a communications change management background mm-hmm. for some big companies, Caterpillar, Blue Cross, she just had this way of like cutting it down to like things that make sense, that are digestible, mm-hmm. that can be done.
Very great.
And she can run across a lot of those relationships inside mm-hmm. and outside of my business
yeah.
and kind of know how to set me up to serve those relationships
better. I love
better.
That. That's fantastic. Good for you.
Yeah.
So it's made a huge difference for you.
Huge difference. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Good.
But it's fascinating that that was where your pivot came from. Mm-hmm. And I totally see it, this whole concept that founders, CEOs are owned by their business mm-hmm. because I was that firefighter. I was the person who when I was like, oh, my people are struggling. They're stressed about something. I'm going to jump in and help fix it. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't really creating the learning and growth opportunities
for
effective.
Them. Super not effective.
Nope. Nope.
How long have you had her by your side, Dane?
It would be coming up on 2 years now.
So what's been the difference in your revenues? Have you grown more
yeah,
than
revenues,
before
revenues
her?
Revenues definitely up probably okay. 25 to 30% in 2 years, which is great in this market.
It's fantastic. Yeah, good.
And I would actually say going beyond the revenue, I think we've become far more clear around going back to your three product, like what are we offering mm-hmm. And how are we offering it? And I think we have become more clear on talent, which is who's doing what jobs and how do we break down some of those silos that that traditionally appear in businesses. Mm-hmm. So it's definitely driving an organizational health, which at an individual task level, and I'd be intrigued by how you see this with your 3-month, 3-phase, 9-step process. Individual tasks alone don't feel like they're really moving the needle on those three things. But actually, when you look at them in concert, mm-hmm. she's orchestrating a whole bunch of things that are moving those three dials.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I agree. You know, and my engagement can be extended up to 6 months.
Yeah.
And partly it depends on the size of the company, right? So, I mean, I say it's something that should be completed in 3 months. But if I've got a larger company that's got considerably more employees, it's probably going to take longer.
Yeah.
Right. And you know, that, so that's all the kind of the whole boutique solution, right? But the bottom line is that the first thing I do is I go in and I do, let's call it a gap analysis. Some people could call it discovery. You know, we call it an architectural review, right? Let's see where you are. Depending on the size of the company, I interview the executive team. If the company has a board, I interview the board. And we'll usually pick some select people outside of that. Maybe some individual contributors, lower level managers, just depends. And out of those interviews come a roadmap that where I believe we should go moving forward. Now, I've got this 9-step process that I'm going to still follow. But what that's going to do is it may bring out some of the things that were in a blind spot. We just didn't realize it. So we get to do mm-hmm. that. And usually the third step of the first phase is starting to work on communication, because without fail, communication is the lowest common denominator around a company's level of failure or success.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. And then we start working on how are people communicating, especially if you've got different generations, right? I'm at the very bottom of the boomers. I'm just right on the cusp of the boomers and X.
Yeah.
And, you know, people like me communicate very differently.
Tell me more about that. When you go into an organization, how does that present itself?
Well, you may have some Z's in there who, you know, want to communicate by a text. Maybe they don't know how to communicate orally.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And they've got a manager who's, you know, an X who wants to communicate in a particular way. Z wants to communicate in a particular way. We have to sit down and talk about what's going to work.
Yeah.
It's not about my way or the highway, but it's about teaching people. If I can teach people that don't communicate really great how to communicate more effectively, they will go more places in their career.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm here to say, don't rely on AI to teach you how to communicate. It ain't going to happen. I'm not saying don't use AI. We use it. Okay. But I think it has its limits. At least now it does. And companies, if they are smart, are still going to have employees that know how to do the basic fundamentals that fit into their culture.
Yeah.
Period. End of story. Okay.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, that's what that looks like. And then, you know, moving into phase two, I start to rewrite all their position descriptions. I run retained searches internally, basically.
Yep.
Right. I come up with the documents, 40 to 50 questions. And I meet with the stakeholders for the different positions, and we start rewriting their position descriptions. So they're not the typical job descriptions that you see all over the internet.
Which are only getting worse thanks to AI.
Are they? Yeah, that's just so pitiful.
Yeah, because once we took an old job description that at some point in time reflected the work that needed to be done, and then we rehire mm-hmm. against it. Now we make up a job description from the ether, which is drawing from tens of thousands of potential experiences and data and has no context or bearing in what we're doing. And I think we're rushing from something that wasn't entirely accurate to something that looks pretty and might be just fantastical, but isn't the work that needs to be done.
Yeah, that's really a good, I'm really glad to hear. I mean, I'm not glad to hear it, but I'm glad to hear that that's what you're seeing, Dane, because there has never been a time, I don't use that word lightly, where somebody in my kickoff meeting didn't say to me, God, that's a really good question. I never thought about that.
Yeah.
And you know where that question comes from? It comes from over 30 years of doing what I've done.
Yeah. You got to see it.
You know, AI isn't in my meetings with them. So AI is not going to be able to take that intellectual property from me because I don't talk about that.
Yeah.
Only in my personal meetings. And, you know, I don't want AI, you know, recording those meetings, frankly.
Yeah.
Exactly, because I don't want any more of these guys stealing any of my intellectual property.
Yeah.
Right. So we get the position descriptions rewritten, and out of the new position descriptions, this is what I would do for any search, We build competency models.
Mm-hmm.
And there may be 30, 40 competencies. It just depends. Again, it depends on the level of the job. And they're usually in about five different categories, right? So if it's leadership, we're going to look at leadership skills. And there may be several competencies underneath that. Cultural fit, the skills and abilities is another one. You know, those types of things, right?
Yeah.
And the competency models I build are based on a low, medium, or high, each mm-hmm. competency, importance of to be able to do that job successfully, and rated 1 to 5, right?
Yep.
So we use that to interview now, and it makes it more objective. So we need to make sure everybody who's interviewing understands each competency mm-hmm. and how to interview for it. So, for example, let's say we've got a competency that's coming in at high, right? This is very important to do this job successfully. And they've interviewed with 3 people. I got a 2, a 3, and a 5.
Yeah.
So what that does is it starts a conversation internally. Did
yeah.
somebody not understand the competency? Gave it a 5 or 2? Did they ask questions that weren't really related to the competency? Are they judging
yeah.
them too harshly? This way, the 3 of us can now get together and say, this is a really important competency. Let's talk about why you gave them a 2, why you gave them a 3, and why you gave them a 5.
Yeah.
So it takes work. But, you know, turnover is really, really expensive. So let's put in the extra work and try to minimize the probability that we're going to make us screw up a hire.
Yeah. The competency piece is interesting, Carol, because there's been a big movement out there in the world around skills-based hiring, which I often see as being considered as, hey, we're going to hire based on competencies, not whether you've got the experience of doing this role before.
Yeah.
And it seems to be falling flat. It doesn't seem to work, in my opinion. Have you had any exposure experience with that?
I have not lately, no. Because yeah. the only placements I'm doing now are chiefs of staff, right? So
yeah.
because I've been in there for 3 months, maybe up to 6. My 9-step process only covers about 80-ish% of what the CEO needs. The other 20-ish% comes from me working side by side with that person and finding what's in the blind spot.
Yeah.
Right. So we get a higher probability of making the right chief of staff hire, whether it's mm-hmm. fractional or full time.
Yeah.
And I, because of that, I haven't had that problem, but I
yeah.
can see where that would happen, right? Everybody's trying to come up with a new shiny object, the next best thing. And here's the thing that I would say about skills-based hiring.
Yeah.
Is that over 50% of people leave a job in the first 18 months for reasons having nothing to do with their skills and abilities.
Yes.
So what does that leave us with? The cultural fit.
Yeah.
So is that more important? In some cases, I think it is far more important.
Yeah.
There are skills you can teach people.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's certain areas where this is not a skill we can teach.
Correct. On the flip side, I think what I've seen with this skills-based hiring is like, hey, I need someone in my sales team that mm-hmm. is really good at putting video messaging out. So I'm going to go and hire this person who's done lots of social media content.
Mm-hmm.
And that's great. That's a really helpful skill. But if you don't think about the context of the organizational culture or the work that's being done with customers, then that person only really does a part of the role. Like, they're great at sending out videos to get
yeah.
clients on the hook. But once they have the client in conversation, they don't have those skills, the conversation
skills. Right, they don't have any sales skills. So the question is
what
you, sounds like what you need is a social media and a marketing person to do that.
Yeah, you've got to break it up.
Right?
And that's where fractional
is
interesting.
Exactly. I do not, occasionally I come up with an idea for the videos that I do. You know, we have an Instagram and, you know, what we post on LinkedIn.
Yeah.
Occasionally I do, but mostly I don't come up with any of those ideas. They are come up with somebody on my team.
Yeah.
or some buddies.
Yeah.
More than one person, they come up with that. I'm like the talking head.
Yeah.
I mean, it's all my content, it's all my intellectual property, but I am not the genius at putting it together.
Yes, yeah.
I'm the visionary, right? Which is where I think most great CEOs are.
Yeah, and actually, just as a final point on that skills based yeah. hiring, I think the problem with it, and it probably ties to your competency frameworks and models too, is that work can become extremely distributed and fragmented.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're in a small business and you have 18 employees, it's hard to say there's 100 roles that we need to do and not fall into the yeah. trap of bundling 15 of them into one person's job.
Right. Yeah, because I mean, then what you probably are going to get is a jack of all trades, master of none.
Yeah.
Right.
So you've come through the communication, you've got the job descriptions, competency model, and what I'm hearing then is that you're through better understanding of the CEO and their team and what they're there to do, you're able to bring in the right chief of staff to carry that work forward.
Right, right. You know, we put leadership accountability in place. We put really protocols for improvement. So the competency model is not just used for hiring, it's used for performance reviews now.
Yeah.
Right? Because here's the thing. I mean, how often, I don't know what journals you subscribe to, but, you know, I've read plenty of articles in Business Insider and other places, but primarily Business Insider about, gosh, I got laid off. All my performance reviews were great. Nobody told me anything. So what this does is the company may be thinking, well, shit, we don't want to do that because, you know, then they're going to have some ammunition. But, you know, all this does is it gives everybody a better framework for what the specific measurable results you need out of employee are. And it gives the employee a better understanding of what's expected of them.
Yes.
Instead of this sort of erroneous, well, I think this is what I'm supposed to do. Those competencies are really clear on what you're looking for. Now, that doesn't mean that employee is not going to take on more stuff and you know, rise to a higher level, but it gives them what the minimum required is for them to do. So now when you sit down and do a performance review, and that employee's got the competency model.
Yeah.
They know what's expected of them.
Yeah.
So now when you sit down in the performance review, you can have a conversation about that. And frankly, I think it's super important to sit down as you're hiring that person. Of course, you're going to have current employees that you should go over this with as well, to say, this is what we've built.
Yes.
This is what is expected of you. Are you aligned with that?
Yeah.
Right? Because the whole step one of doing this discovery, this architectural review, the gap analysis, whatever we want to call it, the whole point of that is discover where the gaps are.
Yeah.
So, you know, there you go. So it helps the leaders lead better and more effectively. It helps the employee get really clear on what is expected of them. And to what you said, I don't know if it was in our pre-conversation, it allows, or when you're talking about your, maybe it was when we were talking about your chief of staff, it allows you to train teams to be independent.
Yeah.
Because they really know what's expected of them now.
Well, let's pause on that.
Yeah.
Because that's really interesting. Like,
yeah.
We talk a lot about talent. And we talk a lot about organizational culture in two ways. One, organizationally, and then two, individually. But we so infrequently stop to think about the teams. And I believe strongly that teams are the unit of measure in an organization for connection, for innovation, for productivity. So if you do it right, and it sounds like this is how your approach is, you've got to have the organizational footings right so that individuals are clear. But then you really need to spend the right amount of time on how does the team interact amongst themselves and with other teams. And I'm intrigued, like, how do you see that play out in organizations that you go into where there might be, you know, brilliant organizational outline, but then the finance team and the sales team are at odds, or the engineering and the product team, or however that works.
So that's such a great question, and I'm going to give you two answers to it.
Yeah.
So I'm going to give away a little piece of free advice. One of the questions I ask in discovery is, what's the most important department or function in the company that leads to its success?
That's very interesting. Where is that dependency?
Right. And I get different answers from everybody. And I'll never forget, I asked this of a CEO one day in my meeting with him.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, if you talk to my CFO, he's going to say, well, I'm the most important department because I hold the purse strings. He said, if you ask my chief technology officer, he's going to say, well, we're the most important department because we build the product.
Yeah.
And if you ask my head of sales, he's going to say, well, we are because we sell it.
Yes.
I said, oh, that's interesting. What's your answer? And he said to me, and this is the right answer. He said, there is no most important function. We have to work as a team.
Yeah.
I said, why doesn't your team know that?
Yeah.
It was like a deer in headlights.
Yeah.
So that's the first answer. The second answer is, most companies do not have a culture of feedback. I talk about this at length in my book. The culture of feedback is driven by the CEO, and it has to be exampled by the CEO. And the CEO has to have an all-hands meeting, so every single employee is there and say, we're going to build a culture of feedback. Here's what that looks like. Means that anybody at any level can say anything to anybody at any level, below, to the side, or above them, without being worried about being thrown under a bus.
Yeah.
And this is why we have to start doing communication training before we do this.
Because yeah, so they don't blow
you can't just go to somebody and say, boy, you know, you just really pissed me off when you said, yeah, nobody's going to respond really well to that. It's how you approach them. It's, you know, it's the old not what you say, it's how you say it.
Yeah.
Right. And most people don't know how to communicate, especially when you start to get to some of the younger generations.
They find it hard to get in the other people's shoes, I think. I've been guilty of that too. We had Salvatore Manzi come onto the podcast and he talked about the you then me approach or framework. Uh-huh. And I thought that was great because it's just like if you're giving someone feedback about their work, you can be like, hey, if I was in your shoes, I'd want to know how this was happening so that I was able to continue improving in my work. And, you know, I just wanted to share that I'm finding this difficult and I'd like for us to sit down and look at how we might be able to understand it and bridge it. And all of a sudden that's way better than, hey, Billy, that Excel sheet that you give me, it's always late and it's never formatted the way I need it to be.
That's right.
Because all of a sudden I approach them with judgment rather than
that's exactly right. You are 100% on the mark. That's exactly right. You know, when you're talking to somebody, you have to make it about, you know, you. You know, when you sent me that email, here's how it landed in my world. It made me feel judged. It made me feel wrong. Whatever those negative adjectives are, right? And it's a great way, you know, to do it. And to his to your point about where he says, you know, if this was, you know, in your shoes, how would you feel? And you know, I don't know if that's the best way to lead into it, in my opinion, but it's certainly appropriate. I had to have that conversation with my boyfriend recently, in fact.
Yeah.
You know, when you text me and don't bother to ever call me for 2 days, here's how it leaves me feeling.
Yeah.
Right? He got that. So, yeah, it's interesting. So that culture feedback has to be driven by the CEO and you have to tell people what it looks like. And it doesn't happen overnight. Make sure everybody realizes that this is not going to happen overnight because people don't trust you. They're like, hey, somebody's going to throw me under the bus. I just know it.
Have you got any tips, tricks, approaches that you think help build that trust or accelerate through that moment, particularly for the CEO?
The CEO's got to be the one that's going out and asking for feedback. You know, here's what the CEO says. We're building this. This is what it looks like. And here's why we're building it, because I am committed. I am committed to making this the best company it can be. And it can't be the best company it can be if people who are having issues. It's not a bitch session.
Yeah.
People are being challenged or having a problem with their manager or a coworker or something. If they can't come to me or to their leadership and have an open conversation about it without fear of being judged, assessed, thrown under the bus, then we have failed as a company. So here's my commitment. And we're going to start by me inviting you in to tell me whatever you want to tell me. Good, bad, or indifferent.
Yeah.
And I can give you my guarantee, my word, it will not come back to bite you in the ass.
Correct. It's interesting. We actually busted that myth recently. I was working with Dr. Andre Martin, and I don't disagree with you. I think that works, but I think there's a quicker way to
get there.
The end outcome.
Okay.
So the reason we busted it is if a CEO goes around asking for feedback from people, it, to your point, it takes some time to trust that they can give it. Mm-hmm. If a CEO goes out and says, hey, I heard from Jill down the road that I am failing to set clarity of task and owner and due date at the end of these meetings. And that's what I'm working on right now. All of the sudden, that belief and that trust in the team is that, hey, not only are you asking for feedback, I can see that you're working on yours. Mm-hmm. And so we actually suggested that leaders should first go out and share what they're working on from their feedback, and then ask for more. And that'll compress the cycle.
I love that. I think that's fantastic. And I've written at length and talked about the importance of vulnerability in the CEO.
Mm.
And that's really what this is, right?
100%.
So, I miss talking about that, but that's really, really, really important that the CEO does that, because people will start to understand, to your point, okay. He's exposing him or herself to potentially being ridiculed and criticized.
Yeah.
By being vulnerable. And I think there are a lot of CEOs who are afraid to do that because of that.
100%. So, it actually reminds me of one of the other myths that we busted. And I'd love your view on this, Carol.
Yeah.
One of the myths was, performance management is for people that need, the help. They're struggling. And we busted that and said, actually, performance management is for your high performers too, performance feedback, because your high performers are often four times as productive as your average performer.
Yeah.
And they love challenge. They feed on growth and challenge.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're just leaving them be doing their work and not giving them feedback on how they could get better and better, they're likely to leave. They're likely to go and find challenge somewhere else. So we were suggesting that, CEOs in particular should be spending more time with their high performers.
It would never even dawn on me not to do that.
That's just built into your approach.
Well, it is, because the level of people that I placed over the years.
Yes.
And that kind of thing. I'll never forget.
It's amazing how many leaders don't.
Yeah. I'll never forget back earlier in my career, I had a candidate down in Florida, and he was a major accounts guy, right? And he, had one of the big accounts, might have been Florida Power and Light, I can't remember. One of the among others, that was one of his biggest accounts. He'd been calling on it for years. And, you go to different tech companies, they want somebody that knows those accounts, right?
Yeah.
And he was working with, back in those days, what, was called data warehousing.
Uh-huh.
which has became business intelligence, and, that's morphed along the years, right? And I won't mention who the company was, but the CEO, who was the founder, comes in and decides to take that giant account away from him because the founder was a tech guy. And so many of these tech founders hate salespeople. I don't know if they still do, but they sure did back then, a lot of them.
Yeah.
Right. And that's the point. What's the most important department or function? There is none. You better start learning to work together or you're all screwed.
Yeah.
And no sooner did that account be taken away from him, guess what the first thing he did was?
Leave.
Sales guy. Yeah. Called, Carol, I'm looking for a new job.
Yeah.
I mean, it's such stupidity, I can't even imagine.
But you see it all the time. Yeah.
Yeah,
I've been guilty of it too.
Same mistakes over and over and over and over. And I'm like, does no one know the definition of insanity over here?
Yeah.
Hello? Here's
one on that. It's interesting, the rubs. Like, salespeople often do rub against finance or engineering or others because we're built differently.
Yeah.
And we're wired differently, motivated towards things that are, not always quality.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Motivated to win, to build relationships, to bring that forward.
Mm-hmm.
But when you go into a team and you see some strong clash or personalities, and yet they're critical. I've heard certain business leaders say, hey, every now and again, you've got to put up with an asshole in a function because they do really important work for the business. And other leaders are like, we have a no assholes policy. And it's just
well,
when you're in a small business, where do you land on that? Because, sometimes you can't shift the behavior or shift the person very quickly.
My answer as often is it depends.
Yeah.
It depends on how negatively is that person affecting the rest of your team. Is one person, any of those who are listening to this who are old Star Trek fans from the very beginning, right?
Yeah.
What did Spock say? The needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few, which I thought was so great, right? I had a prospect, God, so many years ago, good buddy of mine took on, he was the seventh, no, the sixth head of sales in 7.5 years.
Ooh, that's some churn.
Yeah. He wanted to bring me in to work with the CEO. And it turned out that the founder and CEO was the roommate of their lead venture capitalist back when they were at MIT. Again, I'm not going to tell you the name of this company.
Right.
They were the venture capital firm was here in Colorado, and the company was headquartered, I can't remember where. But and ultimately, everyone I interviewed, I think probably three of the former heads of sales, confidentially. I just reached out to them, as well as some other employees who no longer worked there. And without exception, everyone told me that I think it was the chief strategy officer at that time.
Right.
But one of the executives, I think it was the chief strategy officer, was a, and I quote, a cancer to the team.
Oof.
So I reached out to a buddy of mine who was a partner of this venture capitalist. And he goes, yeah, call him. He'll be happy to talk to you. And I did. And the guy was so defensive. Are you telling me that we don't know what we're doing? I said, well, you've had six heads of sales in 7.5 years. What does that tell you? Right. And I interviewed a number of former employees and they said this to me. Like, I mean, I'm not here to, but there's some problems. Question is, the company's no longer in existence. I think they sold the technology. They just couldn't manage to come out of it.
Mm.
And this venture capitalist was like, well, I'm just going to keep doing what we're doing. Okay, well, good luck with that. You know, he was early on in his venture capital career. He'd had one successful company. That's a whole other story about people who become venture capitalists that had one successful company.
Yes.
You know, was it a success because they knew what they were doing, or were they actually Forrest Gump, right?
Fell ass backwards into it.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So if you've got that kind of response, you better start either getting that person coaching and see if you can't dive into what the problem really is.
Yeah.
And see if you can't change that behavior. I mean, that's the first thing I would do. I wouldn't think about just firing them right out of the box. You got to give them an opportunity to get them a great executive coach that knows how to do what they know how to do.
Yeah.
Right? And knows how to find those blind spots. Like, what's causing this behavior? Right? You don't have business problems. You have personal problems that show up in your business. Mm. No one is good enough to not have that happen. Not even me. And I'm really good because I've had years and years and years of training. But, right? So, and if you put in the effort, if that person's that important to you, if you put in the effort and you just, 6 months down the road, you're like, we just can't make any changes. Then you seriously, I'm here to tell you, seriously need to find, to start thinking about replacing that person and just doing confidential search.
Yeah. I love that you called out there, Carol, that you've got personal problems that show up in the business. Because I've also seen the same truth, particularly of some of these CEOs that are owned by their business. Their business problems show up in their personal life too. Like you can't pull them apart.
You cannot. It's like you cannot extricate the two things from each other.
No.
It's super challenging. I mean, CEOs who their family's at the very bottom of the list of things to do.
Yeah.
God, that's just, you know.
It's hard.
And it's very hard. You know, I mean, I've got a buddy of mine who's a CEO. He took over. I've known him many years. This was his first CEO role. He started it in January of 24. So, just over 2 years ago.
Yeah.
He was the third CEO. And the other two CEOs had blown through, I think it was $50 or $60 million.
Ouch.
And they were a $6 million in revenue company.
That's wild.
This company into, in 2 years, $40 million. It's now been sold, right? So he'll be out, looking for a new job here soon. But, that when you look at that and think, my God, that they blew through that kind of money. I mean, that's not a one-off story.
No, it's everywhere.
Yeah. I don't understand it. And what that tells me is venture capitalists, by and large, don't know what they're doing.
I think
they really don't. I hate to do that because I do know some really great venture capitalists, but it means it's like slinging spaghetti at the wall to see what sticks. And I know it's not that simple, but it occurs that way.
Yeah. I think they know what they're looking for, but they put money out early and they force founders who have got great ideas to build at a scale that's quite possibly beyond, going back to your earlier statement, the opportunity to make a difference.
Yeah.
It's beyond how they really originally saw themselves solving a problem in the world because they want to get to 100 million in 5 years and build the unicorn.
Right.
And I think the problem with that, you're right, they don't know what they're doing as far as maybe finding the value in the earlier, smaller growth model because they only want the big wins and therefore they're burning out some brilliant leaders and teams who had something that could have just been a a nice 10 or 15 million ARR business that returned good money to shareholders and made a big impact in the community.
Yeah, it's agreed.
I love your candor and I love the straight talk and just like the clear, the clarity that you bring from the years of experience you've had working with these executives, Carol. I love just as a recap, like how we talked about being talent centric as an organization, going back to your book, Powered by People. And yet where you found that pivot was really focusing in at the chief of staff opportunity, really supporting these leaders to unlock. And and this concept of organizational scaffolding, like it seems so obvious when you present it in the way that you've presented it. And yet so many businesses, leaders just keep going and looking for the silver bullet. What if we open this sales partnership channel? Or what if we offshore our finance function or whatever it is? But they're not really thinking of the whole. So I loved your approach there, particularly starting with communications, getting into jobs and competency models. And then this whole conversation around teams knowing how they help each other and, you know, everyone being critical to the mission and CEOs leading a culture of feedback. It sounds like a pretty cool team to be working on or organization to be a part of.
Thank you. We like it.
Yeah.
At some point soon, I'm going to have to start duplicating myself.
Yeah. With or without AI.
Without.
There you go.
It'll be without AI. My mentor is a big advocate. He wants me to start licensing what it is that I do, instead of hiring more people that can do what I do, license. And that means that's a lot of training. I have to start training people. And that's okay. Yeah. I love doing that. So teaching people to do what I do that already have a certain, you know, background and ability to do that. So,
yeah, that's neat.
That's going to be coming down the pipe here very soon.
So if any of our listeners are either looking for this support for their teams or maybe interested in getting licensed and doing more of this work, how do they find you, Carol?
VerticalElevation.com is the best place. My landing page will talk to you a lot more about what it looks like to have a chief of staff. Talks about the scaffold system. We were just launching a chief of staff ecosystem.
Nice.
For a chief of staff to come in get 5 support calls a month. Mm-hmm. You know, trainings as well as support calls for people who are entering the chief of staff field or they're early in their career, because there's different levels of chiefs of staff.
Yes.
Right? You know, there's some I sometimes see some that I'm like, oh, you've been out of school for 6 months. So that's not a very high-level chief of staff.
And then there's some that are earning $500,000 a year supporting
exactly
CEO
right.
A big
yeah, that's
business.
Exactly right. Yeah. So it just depends.
That's neat. Well, Carol, I've really enjoyed the conversation today.
I have too, Dane.
And thanks for giving me the chance to shine a bit of a spotlight on my chief of staff, Lydia, too.
Yeah, and thank you too. It's been a great conversation. I really appreciate it.
Awesome. We'll talk soon.
Just a quick note before we go. The views and opinions shared in this episode are those of our guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the host, Dane Gruneveld, the Leader Group, our patron Huddle 3, or our partners and affiliates. Any scenarios discussed are for the purpose of fueling creative thinking and conversation, and should be viewed only in this context. Dane, Leader, our sponsors, partners, and affiliates do not endorse any guest or any organization they may be associated with. It's important to remember that every workplace is as individual as the people within it. Our recommendation is to always seek solutions that are specifically designed to help serve your team's unique needs. And to this point, please know we're here, ready to help you find the best way forward, no matter where your starting point is. You can connect with Dane or myself, Alicia McCraw, on LinkedIn or via the links contained in the show notes. Thanks again for tuning in. And hey, if you think someone in your network would benefit from this episode, feel free to share it or give us a 5-star rating. Those 5 little stars really help us reach more curious people like you. We'll catch you next time on the Future of Teamwork.